sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Christmas is almost upon us. The Fed bumps rates and other central banks around the world follow. Big question is, are investors giving up in 2015 and starting to bet on 2016? Our guest today, Tom McClelland, editor of the McClelland Market Report. All this and much more on episode number 443 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, happy holidays to you and to your families, and whether you're celebrating, whether it's Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever else it is out there that you are celebrating, wish you the best of all things. Happy holidays, great health, profitability into the future, and just a great life. So thank you for joining me. We have a couple more shows for the end of the year. We actually have Das coming on next week. A lot of people had, of course, written in that they want to hear what he has to say because he is one of, if not the most favored guest that we have here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And, of course, you can always tell me what you think. You could write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I think I'm coming down with, a cold or I got like a bit of a sore throat. All these parties that I've been to and celebrations over the last few weeks, you know, you do a lot of handshaking and hugging and kissing. And I bet there was somebody in there that was sick that got a little too close, and I got too close to them, and here we go. Anyway, maybe it will pass. So if my voice sounds a little odd, forgive me for this week. But yeah, we did have an interesting week. We had the big rally after the Fed dropped the bombshell that, wow, yep, we are going to be raising rates. It was expected. Then they came out at 2:30 with their conference, their press conference, where it seemed that Janet Yellen was extremely dovish, which I don't know if that's anything different than she's ever been before, because Janet Yellen, since she became the Fed chief, was dovish as can be, really had no indication that anything was going to be different over the long haul, and she has been true at least to that point. But she did say that, we're going to kind of look at this on a regular basis. There is no particular date that we're going to look to raise rates again. We're not going to be having any kind of necessary mechanical mechanism to actually raise rates, and we'll look at this as we see new information from the economy come in, and if in fact we reach our particular mandates, whether it's inflation or employment, we will make adjustments accordingly. Now, what did that do? Well, that was good, because if we know that going into this that Janet Yellen is very dovish, and she continues to be so, maybe she's going to be very reluctant to raise rates until something really, really gets going. We have some substantial growth, GDP growth that grows. And of course, there is no more concern over global growth or any kind of headwinds from currency. But that's not going to happen. That never happens. And when it gets to that point, it's going to be too late anyway. So now what happened is, at least from what I can see, is that the Fed actually imparted much more confusion to the markets. Because at least if there was some kind of mechanical mechanism where they would say that we are going to raise rates every other Fed meeting up until we get to the 1% Fed funds rate or something of that nature, whatever it is exactly, at least there'd be the ability for investors to plan accordingly and to have a good way of understanding what would be happening. Now, each and every meeting that they have will be, quote, live, meaning that we don't know what they're going to do. We don't know if the information that they have coming in is going to be something that we could say is, yeah, that is something that they're going to raise on, and then there may be a disappointment or a surprise. So markets, I think what happened was they really rallied significantly because this you know, the overhead and the cloud that was hovering above markets of uncertainty over what the Fed was going to do was finally lifted, at least for this point, where they're going to raise by 25 basis points, continue to reinvest on the quantitative easing side, and basically everything else is fine. They also imparted to us that the good news that the economy is strong enough for this to occur, and everybody was happy. Markets really rallied in a bit of a relief that finally something was done. And then we had Thursday and Friday, the big turn. We saw that economic numbers around the world were still very concerning. Several places around the world, like Taiwan, I believe Hong Kong, and Mexico, all knocked up their rates also because they're basically tied to the dollar, and they have to make sure that whatever rates we have and whatever strength that we have in terms of our currency filters over to theirs as well. So now we have this knock-on effect that had to happen. So there were some other rate increases around the world. Now all of a sudden we have tightening that seems to be going on. Whereas before it was a constant loosening or at least stability with the rates that were currently there. So that's what happened. Let's kind of just back up a second and talk about the actual level of economic activity in the U.S. from some of the numbers that we saw last year, last week going into this. And I guess the first thing that's continuing to really trouble markets has been the whole oil complex and commodity complex. And there's a lot of reasons why. One of the things is that the dollar strengthened on Wednesday after Yellen. Actually, it was towards the end it stabilized, I should say. Then Thursday it strengthened. And then Friday the dollar got knocked down again. But oil finished the week down 2.5%. Now, there was some news on Friday that there was the lifting of the export ban that's going to go into place, whereas the U.S. Drillers and refiners could actually export out of the U.S. WTI crude. And that was good because it is it's a much better quality oil than Brent. And the price is about $2 lower. So if we can actually export this, and if the shipping fees don't eat up all that price differential, we could see a significant amount of places around the world actually importing our oil now. And that would clearly spark up the demand and hopefully drain some of the supply that we've seen that has built up in the inventories over the last year, year and a half. So Friday, while it did come up a bit and stabilize, it still saw for the full week a 2.5% drop. Now that flows right into the problems that we're continuing to have with the junk bonds or the below grade bonds, because we see that there's a lot of the oil related and I'll call it commodity related bonds that are in that index. And as the commodities continue to come down, the concern over whether or not they're going to be able to pay for their dividends, pay for the interest on the bonds that are due and the principal, well, you see the bonds are selling off. We did see that consumer prices rose about 0.2%. Not a big change. But year over year, we saw the gain of about 2.0. So for the month over month, it was 0.2. And for the year over year, it was 2%. But if you look at the headline numbers over the period, really, there's not much inflation that's going on there. We did see that building starts did climb. Housing starts up 10.5% in November, which was great. It was pretty much reverse of what we saw in October. Building permits surged about 11% last month. That was good. But equities, while we did have that incredible rally that occurred post-Fed, actually were down for the week. NASDAQ down slightly. The Dow down about 0.75%. And the S&P 500 was down about 0.33%. Now, coming up this week, we have a few earnings. Remember, this is going to be a holiday shortened week where Thursday, Christmas Eve, is going to be a half day for markets. And Christmas Day on Friday, markets will be closed in the U.S. and some markets around the world as well. So one of the big things we're going to see here is that on Tuesday, November existing sales will be coming out. Final quarter three GDP will be actually put out by the government as well. Wednesday, we're going to see November personal spending, new homes, K capital goods orders, final consumer sentiment for the University of Michigan. And we're also going to see earnings from Nike, Paychex, Cintas, and Steelcase this week, and amongst a couple of other smaller ones. That's going to be interesting to watch because, of course, we did see FedEx come out with their earnings last week, and actually they beat estimates and guided better. FedEx, Nike, a few other companies are really good bellwethers for global, you know, looking at the global growth and the global economic situation because they are so widespread. We look at FedEx, and of course, we know that FedEx has been doing very well because online shopping has been doing very well. Amazon posted a 20% gain overall during the current holiday season. It's not done yet, but they posted about a 20% gain overall. And obviously, that translates into better revenues for UPS, FedEx, and the post office. So that's good. And as they were not showing any kind of major problems with the global areas, I mean, there's some slowdowns here and there, kind of was actually better than anticipated, I think, and that's why the stock rallied so nicely. We'll see that Nike is coming out. Now, don't forget that they did a whole bunch of things. They increased their dividend. They did a stock split. They did more of a buyback. And their last number showed that China was still very strong. Now, we'll see what's going to happen with this report, because we have been seeing that there's a continuation of the slowdown in China. And I think that's going to be probably pushed through this particular report coming out. We'll have to see how that works out. But it does seem like, even though they were pretty bullish last, we'll have to see how bullish or not they are on the China region, and show how the basically the Asia area in itself has been holding up over the last several months. There's been a variety of indicators that have been out that are showing that things are actually a lot worse in China and in Asia than has been led on to. A couple of reports over the weekend, as a matter of fact, that had showed that there's clearly a much greater slowdown than is seen from some of the interim numbers that we've seen recently. And now that the government is really only trying to keep a 6.5% GDP, you have to wonder how much worse things really are, because we came from a 7.5% to a 6% pretty quickly recently. One of the things that I'm really looking forward to next week is how the various pundits will now twist and try their best to shape the story in terms of what happened with markets on Thursday and Friday. Don't forget that going into the Fed, so many were out there talking about how it's a good thing and markets will rally on a Fed move. And it almost was like when the Fed actually came out and finally announced that they're increasing, that everybody said, oh, well, let's get in there. Anyway, I'm going to keep a close watch on that throughout the week. But in the meantime, our guest today, Tom McClellan. You've heard him before here. He's a great guest and a very knowledgeable fellow. He is the editor of the McClellan Market Report, which we'll talk to you in a bit on how you can get actually a sample of those and look at what's going on with that. So, Tom, how are you?
I'm doing great.
You write some great things, and I'm always looking at your various daily reports, your weekly reports, all the things that you put out there, and looking at the correlations and sometimes the divergences of what's going on. I wanted to start out, though, with a discussion, because I know there's something that you look at more than often on a regular basis is some of the foundation of what you do. And it deals with the advanced decline line. It deals with market breadth. And I wanted you to, first of all, if you could, for our listeners, talk about what is the importance and maybe what it means when we talk about advanced decline lines, and then the concept of market breadth.
Okay, sure, yeah. Advanced decline statistics were first examined back in 1926 by a guy named Leonard Ayers and James Hughes. They worked at the Cleveland Trust Company, and they just wondered what it meant to have to count the number of stock going up and going down, so they started tabulating the data. And it didn't really become popular until the early 1960s, when both Richard Russell and Joe Granville wrote about it in their newsletters, how the advanced decline line, the cumulative total of advances minus declines every day, how that had shown a divergence ahead of the great bear market of 1962, which was a 27% drop for the Dow. So people suddenly got interested in this thing that could be a foreteller of doom, and got a lot more interest in the 60s. We're big devotees of it and big fans of it. When you look at the number of stocks going up and down every day, It's a very egalitarian indicator, because every stock gets a vote and they all vote the same. Bigger companies can skew the volume numbers more, but everybody gets a vote, and so you can start to see if there's an advance going on in the major averages, but you're not seeing the same sort of movement in the advanced decline line, then you know that the money's not being evenly distributed, and that's a sign of illiquidity and problems. And usually that illiquidity and problem, it'll come around to bite the big guys eventually.
And one of the things you talk about, or I talk about too, is the whole concept when you look at, let's say, the S&P 500 as an example here, and you look at that it is a market cap weighted index, in that the larger the stocks, the more they have influence on the price change. And that is, I guess when you look at that advanced decline line, that's even more important than a advanced decline line, let's just say, on a grouping of stocks, right?
Well, there's some disagreement about that. Some people say that you ought to look at the purified advanced decline statistics only for common stocks or only for the index you're looking at. And I am sympathetic to that idea, but I find that the data kind of lead to a different conclusion. The composite list of all the issues listed on the NYSE is over 3,000 issues. Only about 60% of those are what you'd call pure common stocks. There's also some preferred stocks. There's rights. There's warrants. There's closed-end bond funds. There used to be ETFs, but they got moved over to NYSE Arca. But so that other 40% actually turns out to be pretty valuable, because those are the even more liquidity-sensitive issues. When liquidity starts to dry up and not become available, they get hurt first. They're the real canaries in the coal mine.
Right.
And so it turns out that that data actually is more valuable. It's counterintuitive that it should work that way, but it turns out to be that way in the data. And so we started seeing signs of illiquidity problems first this summer in the closed-end bond funds that are traded on the NYSE. And we've since seen it in the high-yield corporate bonds. We've seen it in the overall AD line. We're seeing weakness everywhere. It's illiquidity, not born out of this quarter-point rate hike that the Fed just did this week, but it's illiquidity that's been building and building through natural forces for a long time, and that actually we've been expecting to see coming around at this time of the year.
So now, how much of an influence do the stock buybacks that have been going on, the hundreds of billions of dollars of stock buybacks where they take stock off the market? Now, I know there's other companies that actually are issuing shares as well, but there's been a tremendous amount of stock buybacks. How much does that influence the liquidity factors and then therefore flow through to the breadth and the advanced decline?
That's a terribly difficult question to answer.
A
lot of companies will do the stock buybacks in lieu of doing dividends, because it's a more tax-efficient way of returning wealth to their shareholders. You know, if you issue a dividend, then the shareholders got to pay tax on it right away. But if you do a buyback and reduce the number of shares outstanding, then the earnings get applied over a diminished number of shares, and therefore presumably the share price goes up, and the investor who holds those shares will get that gain, but he doesn't have to pay tax on it until he finally sells the shares.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit more tax efficient. The problem with doing the accounting on all this is that a lot of companies will buy back their own shares, but then they'll issue them right back again to their employees through their stock option program. So you have to do a really deep dive in the accounting to find out what is the net buyback that takes place in a company, and you do spread that across how many thousands of companies to try to get a real idea of the net effect of what the buybacks are all about.
Right. It's
just an immense accounting exercise, so it's really hard to look at that and make meaningful conclusions.
And the more that we have accounting changes, the more that we have companies looking to, camouflage the way things look. I mean, the more difficult it gets over time, and I think that's, many of the proponents of a simplified tax code have a reasonable discussion. The problem is, going from where we are now to there is a very difficult task, right?
That is very true. And it would be great. That Steve Forbes is making the point this week that, all of the time that is spent by accountants spending time figuring out how to calculate your taxes and mine, that's time that is not spent doing more productive things.
Right.
So the more complicated we have a tax code, the more of a drain and a drag it is on society's productivity.
Yeah.
Now, not that I hate accountants. I love them. they do great work.
No, I get it. Yeah, we're not looking to start a run on the unemployment offices for accountants. It's not the point. It's just to try to simplify. That's all. So I got some charts from you, and I want to talk about that because recently this week you had talked about, and you talk about quite often, the whole discussion of commercial positions, or the CRT report, which looks at the holdings of various types of investors with futures. So you have For example, commercial holders, we have the retail holders, and we have hedges and others in there. But one of the things that you look at is in this, the euro dollar, and you do some kind of an offset that I think is really interesting. And actually, you've had this for some time running. This isn't new. And one of the things it is showing you some concerning factors in terms of market action.
Yeah, and before we go too much further, we should specify that when we're referring to euro dollars, that is the interest rate futures product. It's not the currency, right? Euro and the dollar. So a euro dollar in this sense means a dollar-denominated time deposit in European banks. The euro dollar futures contract is the single largest futures contract out there in terms of total open interest. Fed funds pales in comparison. So really, interest rate risk is managed by the big banks using euro dollar futures contracts. And what I discovered back in 2010 is that when you look at the commercial traders, the big money and presumably the smart money, when you look at their net position in euro dollar futures, it gives you a one-year leading indication for what the stock market is going to do. You have a roadmap. And so we've known for almost a year that the decline that we've been seeing this fall and started in the late summer was coming. We've known about it. We've talked about it. We called for an August top almost a year ahead of time because we could see it on the roadmap. And we're calling for a continued decline into around April. We'll probably bang around on the floor again until about October of next year, and then we can finally start upward from a bottom that'll, you know, precede the election in November of 2016.
Now, aside from the fact that this is really good correlation, we'll put this chart on the show notes for this show over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, but do we have any, I mean, sometimes it doesn't really matter the why, but is there a why here?
That's a great question, and first of all, you're right that it doesn't matter if you have enough data to convince you that, yeah, it's working. And it's been working since about 1997. Before 1997, the open interest in euro dollar futures wasn't as big as it got to be after 1997, so it didn't work as well then. Basically, you weren't getting the messages from the bankers about what their loan offsets were and what their liquidity demands were. That is what really shows up in these data. Why it comes out to be a one-year leading indication, I don't really have a good answer. But it's you're measuring the forces that are pushing and pulling on the big banks and what they're doing with offsetting their interest rate risk, and so that's what shows up later. Mm. And I should also mention that it doesn't always work. It had a spectacular failure in 2013 when it was calling for a decline, much like the decline we're experiencing right now, and the Fed did QE3, and that papered over that decline. They basically filled in a pothole with QE, which arguably maybe it was a good thing. It was a lousy thing for me because it didn't work out according to my forecast, but it was probably a good thing for the economy to keep the stock market elevated like they did with QE.
Well, what's interesting is also we obviously know that at least at this point, while there's still some QE going on in the background, the fact is that we still have a changing interest rate environment than we've had over the last 10 years. So the big question is, how does everybody adjust to this? And therefore, you know, what is going to happen if, in fact, the Fed doesn't come in next month and say, you know what, let's go back to zero. That didn't work out last month because markets weren't happy.
Not likely to do that.
Of course not. Of course not.
We've had a rising interest rate environment that the Fed has not really known about or been participating in. The 2-year Treasury note started trending upward a couple of years ago, and it's at 1% now. And really, the Fed tends to screw up interest rate policy when they allow the Fed funds target to get too far away from the 2-year note yield. And if they would just outsource the decision-making about interest rate policy to the 2-year note market, they would do a much better job. When they allow it to get too far away, we end up with the bubbles of various types. They did it in the 1990s, and we got the tech bubble. They did it in the mid-2000s when Greenspan was working on his legacy, and we got the real estate bubble. They've done it again now over the last few years, and we've had the energy bubble that's just now collapsed and is going to have ramifications throughout the financial markets for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Fed, to me, we could go through this, but they seem like a bunch of people who have all good intentions and good information and good information behind them, but they seem highly emotional, it seems to me, which is a really bad play when it comes to doing what they do. You know, they're just so influenced. I should say that, too. You know, everybody's, they're politically influenced. They just seem to be really more and more inclined to work like the Bank of Japan, who is so concerned about the stock market. Under the guise of, well, we want employment and inflation to move higher, because you know, the decisions that they've made recently have clarified that for me. The September rate hike that they were supposed to, that didn't do because of world issues and dynamics. And you know what? If you, this is just a quickie from me, but if you look at September till now, when they actually did the rate increase, things have gotten worse, in my opinion, from an economic standpoint and a global standpoint. So something's not exactly aligned in all this. But
yeah, and it's gotten better from an employment standpoint, but we all know that employment lags, so that's not the best place to go looking for your economic indications of the future. I do think a big part of this is that the officials on the FOMC are just like the rest of us.
Yep.
They like to feel important about what they do, and so they don't want to lose their sense of importance and their sense of authority. I had a subscriber send me an interesting idea by email. He said, you know, if he were on the Fed, he would make sure that they changed the Fed funds target every meeting, even if it was by only one basis point. And that's actually not a bad idea, because then it would desensitize the market to what does it mean if they hike a quarter point? Well,
right.
They, you know, they change rates every time. And that would make everybody not have to pay so much attention and get so hyped up about it.
But then what would we watch on TV? You know? Personally, I'm just so overly sick and tired of, you know, this is my, we'll call it my third of my career. Okay. This is the third that so far of a much longer, it's not the final. I shouldn't say it that way. It's, you know, 10 years, we'll call it every 10 years. And this last 10 years has been so overwhelmingly obnoxious with the Fed and the incredible amount of, weight we put on their decisions, which is important, obviously, but on top of it, the power that we've not only given the Fed here, but what then has transpired around the world and what they think they can do to actually influence various things that they can't. And in fact, are not realizing still to this point that having contradicting methods that at any given time could actually cause more of a problem than not. Anyway, we won't get into that. Let's talk about lumber futures. You know, talking about the idea that there is another correlation that you have found, and that it is about two different ones. One on regarding the housing stock. So talk me through this chart that looks at the near month lumber futures.
Yeah, and almost nobody pays attention to lumber futures. It's a tiny little market in the futures market. I think there's only about 4,000 total contracts of open interest, so it's really hardly any market at all. So nobody pays attention to it. But I started paying attention to it beginning in 2008 when I bought some timber land. And I thought, well, I better pay attention to what wood prices are doing,
right,
as it suddenly became much more real to me. And when I looked at it, I said, hey, I recognize what I'm seeing here. And it turns out that lumber futures prices will give you about a one-year leading indication on what interest rates are going to do, on what home sales are going to do, and on what the performance of the housing stock sector is going to do. And so in a couple charts that I sent you, one compares the price of lumber futures to the HGX, or the Philadelphia Housing Sector Index. And it's key to note that the lumber price data has been shifted forward in the chart by 1 year, so that you can see that the same footsteps are being followed with a one-year lag time. It's important right now because a year ago, lumber prices broke an uptrend line and started trending down into 2015. So the equivalent uptrend line on the HGX is about to get broken, assuming that this correlation works like it has been for the last several years. And the reason for that is because single-family home sales are also correlated to lumber with that same one-year lag time. And so that's pointing downward for new single-family home sales, and that's going to have an understandable effect on the share price of the companies that are doing the building of those homes. And the buildings and the construction of the parts that go into home, you know, some of the stocks in that index are like Weyerhaeuser that makes the 2x4s, and then mm-hmm. there's companies that make the shingles, and Owens Corning makes the insulation, and there's faucet makers and all sorts of other things that are not just the entire home. There's subcomponents of the home that are in that index too. But if people buy fewer homes, then that means they buy fewer shingles.
So now, yeah. So now, generally speaking, I've noticed in the last let's call it 3 months. I don't know if that's exactly the right time frame, but approximately the last 3 months, that generally speaking, you have been looking more for, and you're usually pretty neutral, I think. That's at least my impression of things. You look at the data and you get your information from the data. You don't have any overlying things like, they're doing this and that could be bad. You don't have, like, it's not as much opinion. It's fact-based, at least from the research that you pull and your statistics and all of your various indicators. And it seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, but they've all been more bearish than bullish for the outlook. Am I grabbing that correctly?
They meaning my indicators?
Well, your commentary and your indicators. You've been kind of like leaning towards the bearish side more than the bullish side.
It's because we've been able to see on our leading indicators what's coming.
Mm-hmm.
I like it when I can get the answers ahead of time.
If
you do that in school, then you're cheating. But if you do it in the stock market, then it's good.
So let's get to the McClellan Oscillator, which has been kind of interesting also, that one of the things is that we haven't really seen, even though there's been these big rips and these big dips, but we haven't seen a lot of time being spent in a nice trend above, well above, to a point that you could really be saying, hey, you know what, this is sustainable. It's been kind of very choppy, right?
Yeah, and what people should know about the McClellan Oscillator, my parents developed it back in 1969, Sherman and Marion McClellan, and what it does is it serves as an accelerometer for the advanced decline line. So when it goes up to a really high positive value, that means that the advanced decline line is turning upward rapidly. If it goes down to a deeply negative value, that means that the AD line has been accelerating downward rapidly, and you can get to overbought and oversold extremes that way. Generally speaking, really, really low McClellan oscillator values are conclusive in nature, meaning you're at a bottom and you're all done. But really high ones, up above around plus 150 or even better, higher is better, those tend to show strong upward initiation. You tend to get those at the beginning of a new uptrend, not at the climax or the top of it. Usually the climax of an uptrend is much more quiet, and you have much lower values and quieter values. And so what you were referring to is we haven't seen those strong, positive, high initiation values of the McClellan oscillator. It can get up above the zero line, the neutral level, a little bit, but it doesn't really go anywhere. It doesn't show that strong initiation. And that's exactly what you expect to see during the bear market that we're in and that is due to last until around April.
So the interesting thing is, I think, and this is, I'll throw it at you. One of the reasons why when it hits those low numbers, the negative 200, maybe 250 or whatever it may be, below 200, let's say, which is like, hey, wait a minute, things are getting a little oversold here. People are much more inclined, investors are much more inclined, especially retail, to buy than to sell or to short for that matter. They sell on a panic, but they're always, their baseline is to accumulate. Would you agree with that?
That's true for some people, but emotions are funny. Bottoms tend to be much more violent than tops, and so you generally tend to get the stock market moving in a path that resembles a bouncing tennis ball. It's an inverted parabola, so that you have a very sharp bottoms and you have more rounded tops. And so that's why you have the maximum downward acceleration just before the bottom, and you have the max, which turns out to show a really deeply negative McClellan oscillator value. You have the maximum upward acceleration coming out of the bottom, and that's why you get the really high McClellan oscillator values above zero, well above plus 150, coming right out of the bottom in the first few days and signaling that yes, you're in a new brand new uptrend. Once you get to the top of the path of the bouncing tennis ball, things quiet down and flatten out, and you get much calmer values. But that's also where divergences can appear and can be really useful when you can see them.
Now let's go to one other thing, which is the summation index. And I know that has a much longer term implication, right?
Right.
Where are we on that?
The summation index is calculated based on a running total of all previous McClellan oscillator values. My mother was a math major back in the 1950s when it wasn't really fashionable for women to do that, but she did it anyway. And so she remembered doing calculus and integrating the area under the curve. Well, that's the area under the curve of the McClellan oscillator is driven by how many days you're above or below zero and how far above or below you go. And so that shows up in the cumulative value of the summation index. For long-term historical comparisons, we do one additional step. We calculate what's known as a ratio-adjusted summation index that factors out the changing number of issues on the stock exchange, because that can affect the magnitudes. And when you see the ratio-adjusted summation index go up above plus 500, that says you have a strong new bull market.
Mm-hmm.
When it goes up but fails to get above plus 500 and curls over, then it says you have failed to achieve escape velocity and you're likely to have the rocket ship fallen back down to Earth. And we've just had a signal like that just this fall. And the ratio-adjusted summation index for advanced decline numbers failed right at the 500 line. The one for volume numbers looked even uglier and says we're in a bear market.
Huh, interesting.
So it's an important message to get.
I remember if, back in, I'm not sure what year it was, 2009, 2010, something like that, the summation index got to a point that was something that you hadn't seen in years or decades or
right.
even going back.
Coming out of the 2009 bear market, it went up to gonzo high values because mm-hmm. there was great, strong new liquidity coming in thanks to the Fed starting QE1 and the bear market ending, and people wanted to get back invested. And so there's this gush of money coming in, and it showed up in the advanced decline data, which therefore showed up in the McClellan oscillator and summation index data, and the ratio-adjusted summation index climbed up to double that 500 threshold or a little bit even higher. And so it was just a huge, strong initiation that said we have a monstrously strong new bull market starting.
Yeah.
So that was the important message to get back in 2009. That's not the message we're seeing now, and maybe several months from now we'll have the opportunity to see a message like that, but we have a lot to go through first, a lot more work to do in the bear market to disappoint people and get them muttering to themselves and get them to swear off ever investing in that dang stock market again. And, you know, once we get the thing that accomplished and get all that money pulled off out of the stock market and put the stock in stronger hands, then we can start having start building a new bull market. But the work is not done yet.
And I think for people to just we'll end on this. I think to people to understand, when does that happen? When does it people when do I know when people are just disgusted? Besides me, which may be, you know, never or maybe always, right? Either one.
Well, if you can learn to use your own stomach lining as a contrary indicator, that can be useful.
Right, exactly.
Sometimes you want to use a friend's stomach lining, so you outsource it, and you'll get biofeedback on it. But yeah, but it's a long process. We just topped the market this summer, and we haven't done enough work to the downside to really accomplish all that work. We don't have a turnaround yet, and the high-yield bonds, they still look ugly. We don't have liquidity restored, so there's more work that needs to be done.
Yeah, and the other thing the other thing people could do is they could simply watch some of their favorite financial shows. And when you have nobody liking the market anymore, because right now rate hikes are seemingly good for markets, and low rates are good for markets, and you know, earnings that just meet but didn't disappoint as much are good for the stock, and you know, you go on and on with all the rationalizations why whatever the outcome is a good thing, right? So, oh, we thought it was going to be a lot worse, so let's drive the stock up 10%. But when you get to a point that many of the commentators and guests on there are so negative that they're like, well, you know what? And you start seeing certain players come back, all the bearish players come back and start talking about, yeah, we're going to see a 40% correction from here, et cetera, et cetera. You just look what happened with oil. I mean, while oil is falling currently, you know, at the same levels that more basically a little bit lower than it was. But when oil last time went very low, everybody was, $20, $20, $20, which may be the end product, by the way. But from there, once they got all the negative guys on, it popped up, if you recall correctly, like 20%. So you got to kind of watch that and watch for the contrarian indicators from many of the commentators as well. It seems to work out. Tell everybody how they can get a sample and some information about your newsletters.
Well, the best way is to go to our website, which was named for the McClellan Oscillator that my parents created. It's just shortened to MC Oscillator, so it's like a McNugget, except it's a McOscillator. Or you can just Google Tom McClellan, and you'll probably find us on the Internet. We have a twice-monthly newsletter that's $195 a year. We have a daily edition that comes out every day the market trades for $600 a year. But you can also sign up for a two-week free trial on our website. And if you don't want to pay anything, you can still sign up for our free weekly chart and focus emails. It's a single short article about one chart that's of interest to people. It was just a way to get more people acquainted with the type of work we do.
And the nice thing about Tom's various newsletters also is that just like McDonald's, you can actually read them for breakfast, lunch, or dinner now. They're now available for dinner, like the McNuggets. So McClellan Oscillator is available.
And there's no strings attached. We don't share our mailing list with anybody. So you won't get any spam from us. You won't get marketed to by anybody. And so we try to treat people like we'd want to be treated.
Yeah, appreciate it. Well, you have a great new year. If I don't talk to you, have a great holiday and a great new year. And we will definitely pick it up next year. Tom McClellan, check out all of his great work. We'll put links on the show notes along with the charts that we talked about today so that you can see exactly what we talked about and follow along as we talked about it. And then, of course, you can get his great newsletters and all that. I highly recommend Tom's work. And if you haven't yet gone over there, do yourself a favor, especially for the new year where we're trying to find out ways how we can make profits, how we can get better at investing, and we can, you know, make sure that we have all the tools in our arsenal to get us there. This is one of the ones that's a must read on a daily basis. So check it out. So, hey, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it, buddy.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. So well, let's get back to one of the things I mentioned at the top of the show. And I asked the question, is it possible that investors are, well, they're kind of giving up on 2015 and maybe they're starting to set their eyes on 2016. Oftentimes at the beginning of the month, you will many times at the beginning of the year start seeing a change in dynamic, people getting excited about one thing or the other. It's a new year, new process. This year is going to be the best year ever, you know, whether you're long or short or wherever you're investing. But the big question is, what's happening now? We have only, I guess, from the beginning of this week, we have three and a half trading days this week and three and a half or four trading days next week. Seven trading days about for whatever it is to happen. The S&P is down for the year. The Dow is down for the year. As of right now, the NASDAQ is still up for the year and holding up very nicely, and considering what has gone on recently. And the big question is, they're going to be that rally. Now, that rally would have to be on, I don't know, maybe some news or something that's different. There really is nothing different right now. And the potential for seeing further sell-off, if in fact oil does continue to move lower and junk bonds have a problem, and we are seeing all these stories out of China, is possible. And don't forget that we now have a different rate environment that we're looking at with the Fed. So the big question is, what is going to happen here? And I don't necessarily have the answer about this, but I do think there is the very high probability that we may see the beginnings of a rotation. Now, we have to set some basic structure to this, right? We have to look at the fact that we have a market that has some sectors that are, well, just horrible, just been taken to the woodshed this year and kicked again, then taken to another woodshed and further beaten. You know, you're talking about these commodities and the free ports, and you're talking about many of the oils, not the refiners as much. You're talking about particularly some of the natural gas companies with natural gas well below $2 right now. Europe markets have, you know, done much better. Asia has been all over the place. You look at South America, Latin America, and because a lot of those are commodity related, not doing well, the currencies are getting beaten up. Emerging markets are in real trouble. The big question is, if we have just a very simple rebalancing program that goes into play, whereas there is, and I've talked about this so many times, but if we have this rebalance program, how much of a lift are we going to get on these stocks? Because there is so much short interest on many of these names that the potential for a very quick move is very much possible. Now, I'm not really saying that this is going to happen right now. And Tom, just a minute ago, talked about how the potential for a continuation of a drop into April, he's showing as a high probability because of a variety of different factors. And I'm not going to fight that, because I think that we are pretty much long in the tooth in this economic and market cycle that we've seen that has expanded one of the longest periods over, you know, history. And there is room for, now that we have a slight increase in rates, for some fallback. Now, banks should be doing well, but they got smacked on Thursday and Friday, as did the whole market, of course. But banks have raised their rate, their core lending rate, and many of them said they're not going to be increasing the actual rate they pay on deposit accounts. So the spread just widened for them. They're earning more money on the differential for new loans or maybe variable interest rate loans, and they're not going to pay you anything more in your bank account or your checking account or your savings account or your CDs. So the spread just increased for them. But meanwhile, we saw this big drop on Friday. Is it because there is still a lot of concern over the fact that we have an increase now and oil is down and the holdings in bonds will be really suspect? And because the fact that we're seeing a slowdown in the U.S. economy, possibly. Or is it kind of like there are so many players on one side versus the other that the natural process is to try to blow out, you know, these algorithms blowing out positions and stops and short positions and taking it up? I mean, we saw that on Friday, some of the major commodity companies that have been just getting whipped and whacked throughout the year did very nicely. Many of the very highly shorted names did very nicely, where the quote-unquote solid plays, the ones that haven't really taken major hits this year so far in the same degree, really did very poorly. So is it simply that is the rebalancing that is happening right now? Let's clean up, because at the end of the year, we want to make sure that, of course, that our portfolios are cleaned up with any losses or gains that we want to clean up. We have to have, IRA distributions are mandated to take if you're over the age of 70 and a half by the end of the year. Maybe you're saying, okay, well, I waited. I'm going to sell now. And I'm going to take whatever it is. I'm not going to worry about the rest of the year because we have lower volume usually towards the end of the year. There could be greater volatility towards the end of the year. Let's not risk it anymore. Let me take some off the table right now. Let me turn it into cash and let me make it my required minimum distribution for my IRA. That's possible as well. We also have many funds that maybe are in trouble in the junk bond and below investment grade area that are seeing a lot of redemptions. We also see a lot of redemptions in the universe of equities over the last couple of weeks as well from mutual funds and ETFs. So maybe this rotation is beginning from the large cap, mega cap, names that have withstood pretty much anything that was thrown at it this year. And they're starting to say, you know what, there's better value in some of these beaten down names. Yeah, many of them are falling knives still, but eventually, unless they go bankrupt, there's going to be an opportunity here. So just kind of keep your antennas tuned to that concept going into next year, because if you've ever looked at a historical reference of sectors that perform and underperform each and every year, usually have a couple of 3 years that maybe there's one particular sector that will just horribly underperform every other sector. But the next year, they're the number one sector, probably because there's not a lot to get them boosted up into that position. And then the other ones fall down. So many times we get caught up in this whole idea that, well, this is what it's going to be like forever. But that doesn't play out very well. And you know that. But we still get caught up in this. It's going to be, oh man, the Fed is going to have control and keep the economy buzzing forever. They finally know how to get it right. Or growth funds, growth stocks, technology, it's going to go up forever. The sky's the limit. Listen, we thought that when it came to biotechs through April of this year. That didn't play out very well, did it? So keep your senses about you, your emotions in check. Make sure that next year that, well, at all times, but particularly as one of the resolutions for next year, that you make sure that, you know what, you're going to use good principles. You're going to stick to your stops, stick to your limits, stick to your price targets. Don't use emotions. Try to find those basing positions that will give us an opportunity to make some nice money. And if it hits our target, you're out. Let's find the levels that if they break down, if I have a stock that's moving up and I've had it for a while and I thought that, hey, this is a great stock, but something is happening to its price, I don't hold on to it just because I like it, just because I shop there, just because I like those flavors of ice cream, just because I like their soup or their shoes. Don't use that as the only criteria. Go back to making sure that you write down your rationale for each and every trade or position or investment or your total portfolio allocation. Make sure that you do the right thing for yourself so that in the long term, you will be much better off financially and you don't have as much agita through the whole process. You know, whereas you're like, oh, I own this stock and why do you have it? If somebody came up to you and said, hey, why do you own that stock? Why do you own that mutual fund? Why do you own that ETF? You can give them an answer. And 4 months post that question, if it's asked again, you could once again give an answer. Not, well, I just held on to it. I should have gotten rid of it. I have friends who I went out to dinner with not too long ago, and we were talking, and I told him, listen, you know, he gave me a list of his stocks that he owned. I said, you know, okay, many of those are fine. I said, you know, one of the ones that really sticks out to me is GoPro. Not to beat this horse to death, but it's GoPro. I said, you know, you got to be really careful with that stock. I have a really bad view of it because, and I gave him the list of fundamental reasons why there could be some problems. I said, be careful, put a stop below this level and just get out if it breaks down. Now that was at about 70 or so. I think the stock is trading at 18-ish, 19. But I saw him the other night. I said, hey, how's it going? And we talked to him. He said, oh, I held on to my GoPro. I said, well, why did you do that? Well, it was going down. I kind of had some losses and I really didn't want, I thought maybe it would pop back up. But I said, how often did you think this? Because you had so many different opportunities to move out of that position. She says, I know, but you know, I just kind of felt like, ah, one day it will come back. I like the stock. I like the company. And, you know, he gave me no reasons why, but he basically saw that it was at once much higher. And the potential for, if it did drop 50%, for it to pop back up quickly was, hey, that's going to be, you know, something I'm going to do and something I'm going to stick to. So he broke his basic premise of why he was holding the stock. He broke the idea that when he committed to a level that he was going to get out of it or back into it, he broke that. And, well, the result, devastating. You know, stock's down like 75% since we talked about it, and probably about 80% or so since he bought it. So just be careful not to fall into that trap, because the only one that's going to hurt is you. And don't be so fearful that, well, that stock's been dropping and dropping, and, well, while it's basing out now, maybe it could drop more. I don't know. Look at the fundamentals. Look at the environment. Look at the situation. And you know what? Sometimes you may want to take a shot. The worst that can happen is it comes down maybe 5% or so, 6%, and you're out of it. But you can take a shot again at it. Don't make the mistake of not going back to a position if it didn't work out the first one or two times. Because that, if you keep a level of stops on that are tight, and just, you know, kind of, I thought it was basing out, technicals look right, maybe some of my oscillators or my trenders, they were starting to turn up. Hey, you know what? I'll take a shot there. And it didn't work out. And you're like, oh, I'm never doing that again. No, no. The stock may not stay down forever. It may have just been a slight timing issue, maybe a little bit too early. So remember that. If it is a good idea, it may just be a timing situation. Same thing with shorts. You think about all the things that have gone on in terms of stocks and those stocks that were holding up forever. And look at Disney, what happened a few months ago. Disney was just going up and up. You would never look to short that, because if you did over the last several years, you got your head handed to you. But once it did start coming down, if you said, well, I'm not going to go after that because, well, you know, last time I lost a little bit of money and I just don't think. No, but you know what? If you committed to something, and whatever the reason was, and you went actually into that short, you made nice money. A good example of what we did for our clients not too long ago was we went short Best Buy, made about 8 or 9%. And right at that level, we saw that was a good support level. We closed the position. Actually, the position popped, or the stock popped right back up close to where it was before it dropped. And we shorted again. It didn't do much for a while. And now it's up nicely for us on that short. Shake Shack, we've gone in and out of many times. And now we're up about 24% on that short position. So again, you have to commit and stick to your basic thesis if the thesis you believe continues. And if you're proven wrong, make sure you don't lose too much money on that. But when the time comes and you're right, you know what? Don't let it run away from you. Anyway, Christmas is here. Let's keep the cheer alive. Make sure that you are going to be very profitable, because I know you will be. We're going to have some great guests. Like I said, Das is coming on next week, and we'll kind of end the year with Das and talk about a variety of things. If you want to send some questions in for Das, of course, you could do so. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com, or you could tweet it to me at Andrew Horowitz, one word, and we'll make sure to get that on. Of course, you can listen to DH Unplugged each and every week on Tuesday evenings as well, or Wednesdays, whenever you want, but it comes out on Tuesday evenings. But otherwise, thanks for listening. Any questions you have, please send them in. And make sure to go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com to see all the information and show notes from this episode, as well as the charts that Tom McClellan had put up, as well as if you're interested in us managing your money for you. There's several areas where you can find out more information. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great Christmas. And hopefully you're going to spend a nice time with your family and exchange not only gifts, but also love and all the good things that come along with spending time with family and friends. Be safe. I'll see you next week. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.